loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, today marks the 65th anniversary of the Armistice Agreement in the Korean War. But the peninsula technically remains in a state of war to this day. To mark the occasion and push forward toward a permanent peace treaty, North Korea today repatriated the remains of 55 U.S. servicemen killed during the war, the result of a promise North Korean leader Kim Jong-un made to President Trump when they met in Singapore last month. More than 7,000 Americans are still listed as missing in action in North Korea. Next, President Trump called today's news that gross domestic product had grown at a very robust 4.1% for the second quarter of 2018, amazing. He didn't comment, however, on the fact that much of the growth was due to consumers making major purchases before the effect of tariffs begins. He also promised that GDP, quote, would go a lot higher than this, unquote. Then the online news site The Daily Beast reported unequivocally today that, quote, the Russian intelligence agency behind the 2016 election cyber attacks targeted Senator Claire McCaskill as she began her 2018 re-election campaign, unquote. The Daily Beast cites as proof its own forensic analysis and specifically blames the GRU, Russia's military intelligence service. The story already has been repeated as fact by National Public Radio. And then Donald Trump thought he had a deal with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan to release a U.S. pastor being held in Turkey on trumped-up espionage charges in exchange for Israel releasing a Turkish woman being held on espionage charges there. But that deal fell through, leading to angry and threatening tweets between the two leaders. The result has been a quick and significant downturn in U.S.-Turkish relations. And finally, it's Friday, so we'll take a look at the week's worst and most misleading headlines. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to Korea. Today marks the 65th anniversary of the Armistice Agreement ending the Korean War, but the peninsula technically remains in a state of war even to this day. To mark the occasion and push forward towards a permanent peace treaty, North Korea, the DPRK, today repatriated the remains of 55 U.S. servicemen killed during the Korean War, the result of a promise North Korean leader Kim Jong-un made to President Trump when they met in Singapore last month. More than 7,000 Americans are still listed as missing in action in North Korea. We're going to talk about what's next for the Korean Peninsula and U.S. relations with South and North Korea. We're joined from Seattle by Professor Simone Chun. She's a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute and a member of the Korean Peace Network. Simone, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Such a historic day. 65 years ago today, that terrible war, at least the military side of it, came to an end. I was reading a book a while ago by the physicist Michio Kaku, who had gotten hold of unclassified or previously classified Pentagon documents. The Joint Chiefs of Staff had agreed as of May 1953 to actually start dropping nuclear bombs all over North Korea and parts of China unless the DPRK signed an armistice agreement. The U.S. wanted to end the war at that point. It could not win the war. It was driven south from where it had occupied North Korea. But Simone, here we are 65 years later. Unlike every other war that has a beginning and an end, this war only still has a beginning, no end.
Brian, that is true. You know, the peace agreement is supposed to be signed within 90 days of the armistice, but which never happened. And today, obviously, in North Korea, we've been ahead of us. North Korea celebrated. They're celebrating today 65th anniversary as a victory day. But unlike the previous years, this year is quite interesting. We need to pay attention to. It says victory day. There was no visible anti-American propagandas and banners, and so which really indicates the. What is happening right now. As bad as it is, as we first need to actually, celebrate the progresses that have been made. As we quote, we have about 235 days without, the kind of provocation from both sides that we had. Also, you mentioned that, 55 servicemen missing in North Korea, in the Korean War, being repatriated. And there are still, I believe, about 5,000 5,300 American servicemen who are still unaccounted. And also going back to this, the brutality and of Korean War. As you remember, about depending on the statistic, you're looking at it from something like 4 million, from between 3 to 5 million people were killed, injured, missing, which, and most of them were civilians. And Korean War left about 100,000 war orphans and 300,000 war widows, and almost 10 million divided, family members, which is, in 1953, would have been one-third of the entire Korean population were separated. So that is, that is the really, this is truly the one of the most, brutal war. And as you pointed out, every war has beginning and ending, and this is the only war that, that has not ended, and as we can talk more about it. And this is, in fact, the best time that we can now work toward a peace agreement to end the war and then start a new process.
Yes, thank you for those words. I traveled around North Korea and South Korea with a videographer in 2001, and I was taking the testimony of survivors of the Korean War from the North and the South, people in the villages, towns. It was an amazing story. Very, very old people now, of course. And that was then. I mean, now we're 17 years later. Then we had something called a U.S. Independent Commission of Inquiry at Riverside Church. And the South Korean people I videotaped came. They came and gave testimony. And what Americans don't know is that they were being killed. The civilians were being killed. The biggest part of the death toll, as Simone is pointing out, were civilians. And the U.S. government position was they never knew if North Korean guerrillas or pro-North Korean guerrillas were hiding among civilians. So they just didn't take any chances, so-called. They just shot first and didn't even ask questions later. But that was the attitude, like, this, let's gun them down. The North Koreans who I interviewed, Simone, they weren't allowed visas so that they could come and give direct testimony. So we had to bring their videotape testimony back. Korea's the so-called forgotten war in the United States, not in Korea, of course. But Americans need to know the history of this war. That's why I'm glad you raised, those are staggering numbers, 4 to 5 million people. And that's, according to the Encyclopedia Britannica, I looked it up in 1967, they said about 5 million people died who would not have died otherwise. And that might have been like 20% of all Koreans.
Yeah, in fact, I feel that as a Korean, actually, sometimes I feel like a miracle that my family, there has been no, major casualties. And in fact, then you add that 36 years of a brutal Japanese colonization, which also left, before the Korean War, left a massive human suffering. And literally, basically, we're talking about one out of four Koreans, have been affected. And this is also the issue, even not only in Korea, but also there's 100, 1,000 Korean Americans who are even still to this day who have remain separated without being able to go back to, visiting their families in North Korea. So I think it is very important that Americans should know that this is about, this is really what's a really brutal war that has to end it. And America is really refusing, even up to this today, refusing to sign a peace treaty. And we really need to, tell Congress and the importance of signing peace treaty. And and also we have to remember North Korea has done, really made very, very proactive steps. Even this year, within the last 6 months, they have done, they cooperated with Pyeongchang Winter Olympics. They released those American prisoners and they holding, inter-Korean summit and implementing nuclear test moratorium and missile test moratorium and closed up, destroy some of the nuclear test site. And at this point, repatriating all those American soldiers. And but what I'm very, very, very concerned is the lack of United States action. And moreover, this morning, I'm hearing United States, the Congress is becoming completely obstructionist. They are, you heard that about the Congress is bipartisan. sort of passing, you know, a resolution or demanding that, or preventing, let's say, you know, Trump from unilaterally removing U.S. troops from Korea.
Terrible.
Et cetera. Yeah, so so I think that this is something that we really have to, you know, point out. The North Korea has been very forthcoming, and there's not enough action from the United States.
Yeah, it's terrible. I mean, here you have the Republicans and Democrats who can't agree about anything. They can't agree about how to rebuild the bridges of the country, how to have high-speed rail, about meeting people's health care needs, affordable housing. But when it comes to empire, when it comes to retaining 32,000-plus U.S. troops in southern Korea, 65 years after this war technically came to an end, then you have all this pressure. It's like a constant war lobby. A constant war lobby, and it's the Democrats and it's the Republicans. And, you know, I think the other thing that we have to pay attention to is what Simone is saying. The North Koreans have taken now 6 or 7 major unilateral steps showing good faith. The moratorium on missile tests, the moratorium on nuclear weapons tests, et cetera, et cetera. And still all the U.S. government officials do is ramp up rhetoric against the DPRK. I mean, the North Koreans are insisting, and I think this is true for Moon Jae-in too, the South Korean government, reciprocity, step by step. Both sides have to do something. Go ahead.
Yes, I think that, you know, even former diplomats and also many are now saying that, you know, there has to be some kind of diplomatic give and take. And I read the comparer, you know, referring to this latest North Korea's action. He said, well, you know, it's great, but we still have an awful long way to go. But United States has done so far. I see they have done only one thing, that is, you know, maybe two, canceling the suspending the U.S. South Korea war game, and also, you know, having one summit. And that's about it. And then it's a very, and it's not even interest for the United States. Even let's say talk about peace treaty. A lot of Americans, you know, argue that some of those, especially neocon security establishment, argue that, well, you know, peace treaty will basically then, you know, will threaten the U.S. troops in South Korea. But it's not true. Actually, some argue that peace treaty is actually United States, it won't change much about, you know, status quo. It is actually very low cost, and also actually improve atmosphere and help the, in fact, help the even denuclearization process. But I think what happened is that in the Congress, we have 535 some members of Congress. As you know, almost many of the districts, they have this huge funding for the military industrial complex, right? So they're all basically, and also you just, what was the latest, the defense, the bill?
$718 billion. Simone, we're out of time. We've been joined from Seattle by Professor Simone Chun, a strong, eloquent voice on the issue of peace on the Korean Peninsula. She's a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute, and she is a member of the Korean Peace Network. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
President Trump called today's news that gross domestic product had grown at a very robust 4.1% for the second quarter of 2018 amazing. He didn't comment, however, on the fact that much of the growth was due to consumers making major purchases before the effect of tariffs begins. He also promised that GDP, quote, would go a lot higher than this, unquote. We're joined from Philadelphia by Dave Lindorf, an investigative reporter, columnist for Counterpunch, and a contributor to Business Week, The Nation, Extra, and Salon.com. Dave, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Dave, 4.1% is very healthy, but there's more to this than meets the eye. What do you think?
Well, first of all, it's a 4.1% rate if, annualized. So we're only talking about a blip on a quarter. And it was one that was expected because, you know, so many companies are stockpiling things that would be requiring tariffs and so are spending money. And also places like China are stockpiling things like soybeans, which are going to have reverse tariffs put on them. So I read that soybean sales rose by over 9% this past quarter, and that That's China. China's virtually our entire soybean market. So these are significant amounts. I mean, a quarter of the growth of this quarter they're reporting on was a surge in exports, all trade war related.
Just so we understand, China, anticipating that prices were going to go up as a result of the trade war, was stocking its inventory by buying more right now. And that's been true across the board with any sort of purchasing overseas. In other words, a lot of overseas importers of American products are buying them now because they don't know. They have uncertainty about what the price will be later. That's actually what's happened. That's been at least a big part of this surge in the GDP.
Right. That's exactly right. And then you know, consumers also, we don't have figures on that, but the consumers, who represent 70% of the GDP annually, just retail purchases, are also buying all the things that they're hearing are going to cost more. If you wanted to buy a German car, for example, you're hearing that there might be 20% tariffs on it. Then you're going to buy it a few months early and get the ones that are in the lot instead of waiting, you know, until fall when you suddenly have to pay 20% more for your car. So, you know, there's a lot of U.S. spending, which is money into the dealerships and gets reported as GDP. And then finally, you know, the other thing is that the financialization of the U.S. economy is proceeding apace. In like 2013, 9% of GDP was financial transactions, and that's up from 5% in 1980 and 2% back at the turn of the century. It's churning money, basically, and making enormous profits, salaries and bonuses and stuff for the banks, which is a small percentage of the population, but we're probably up over 10% of GDP is financial because it's rising on a, you know, fairly rapid rate. And the financial sector is doing great because of continuing deregulation, first under, the Reagan administration and now under the Trump administration. So those banks just do great when they're deregulated. And so that's another big factor.
Dave, I can't help but to think, too, that we're in for a hit. And the reason I say that is at the beginning of the week, the president made news by criticizing the Fed's decision to raise interest rates. And typically, presidents just stay out of that whole debate. But this president jumped right in and said that the Fed had made a mistake by raising the interest rates on Monday. Well, combining tariffs with a strong growth rate, I mean, that obviously leads to inflation. And inflation leads the Fed to then raise interest rates again to cool the economy down. So here you have the president promising higher GDP growth than 4.1. He said it's going to get way higher. He said that this morning, but he's not talking about the Fed raising interest rates to cool things down. And that just makes me think that regardless of what he says, we're in for much smaller, much slower GDP growth.
Dave, before you respond to John on that, let me just ask you, we're talking to Dave Lindorf, by the way. He's an investigative reporter. We're talking about the announced increase of the gross domestic product for this quarter to 4.1%. There's other elements. I'm looking at the Wall Street Journal from this morning. Uncertainty puts hold on steel's rally. This is, of course, the steel industry. American steel companies are benefiting from tariffs on foreign steel. But what they're doing is really, really, really raising the price in the futures. Steel futures are going way up. And as a consequence, companies that rely on steel or rely on aluminum are having to pay a lot more. And I'm talking about American companies. We're talking about Ford, GM. Chrysler's no longer an American car company. They're feeling the big crunch because of the increased costs that have to be passed on probably to consumers. Appliance maker Whirlpool Corporation cut its full-year profit outlook earlier this week as its costs continue to rise, saying that, quote, domestic steel prices have, quote, reached unexplainable levels. That's Whirlpool. Of course, that means the steel barons are taking advantage of the tariffs. They're not lowering the price, which they could do and still beat out the competition because the competition has a 25% price hike automatically put on it, known as a tariff. They're just raising their prices. Anyway, It's the unintended consequences. Go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, well, also, you know, there isn't really a steel boom because the steel industry in the United States is tiny. The big, you know, Bessemer furnaces have long gone and are rusted away, and it's all really sort of mini mills, and they've been cranking anyway, you know, all along. It's not like, you know, Trump will go to Bethlehem, you know, and say steel is back. Well, if you've ever been to Bethlehem in Pennsylvania, you know, there's just these rusting relics, the ones that haven't been torn down yet, and there's no steel being made in Bethlehem. You can tell the old retired steelworkers that it's back, but I guess, you know, most of them are out in the Sun Belt somewhere, you know, cooling out by the pool. They're retired, but nobody's getting hired back to build steel. And what this means is that, you know, the U.S. industry right now is pretty much cranking at full capacity. So if you stimulate the economy, which has happened with the tax cut on a short-term basis, there's no way they can make more goods to be bought from domestic producers. And so that means prices go up.
The other part of this, too, John and Dave, is that when China and India, for instance, and in particular China, are facing steep tariffs on, say, Chinese-produced steel, what are they going to do?
Right.
They're going to produce more steel because they need to be able to rely on domestic producers. Even with tariffs on steel, again, this is the Wall Street Journal from today. Supply has grown steadily outside the United States. Global steel production increased 4.6% in the first half of this year, and most of it in China and India.
Yeah, that's right. Those are the two big steel producers. The trade war is so backwards and outmoded that, and also it's like this, it's like trying to attack problems with a shotgun instead of a rifle. There's so much collateral damage when you try to use a trade war to achieve your goals. It's not going to work, and it's going to cause more inflation in the U.S. because so much of what we buy in the U.S. is imported. Necessarily, because we've destroyed our industrial base. So consumers are going to buy what they need. You know, Whirlpool, for example, I don't even know if they make washing machines in the United States anymore. They were bought by China, and they're made in China, I think. So, you know, if you need a washing machine, you got to get an imported one. And then if you have to pay the tariff on it, well, what are you going to do? Hang your clothes out in the lawn? No one does that anymore. So they're going to pay more, and that means inflation. So we're going to see rampant inflation and driven by imports, and the tariffs be damned. The whole thing is a fiasco. And I was reading one banker, I think it was Barclays analyst, saying that on the other side of the second quarter, growth is a gaping hole because so much of it is advanced buying ahead of tariffs.
That's exactly what it is. We're setting ourselves up here for an economic bubble. Maybe it's a small one, but it's going to hit, and it's going to hit in 3 months.
Dave is giving us economic insight. I want to pick your brain for the last 45 seconds, Dave. What will happen politically? Is this working for Trump?
Well, that's always a question. You know, Americans tend to vote for the incumbents when the economy is growing and to punish them when the economy is not. And, you know, you could argue cynically that this is an effort to pump up the economy, that the tax cut and so on was a cynical effort to pump up the economy with a bubble before the November elections. And whether that timing works or not is hard to say. It's August, September, October. You got 3 months. A 3 month bubble might happen. And so if the bottom doesn't fall out before November, it might be a good strategy for the congressional elections. It's not going to be great news for the president on 2020, though, because I think we're headed for another, you know, big economic collapse.
It's crunch time. That's what we're coming to.
Well, they're planning every 6 months. They're not doing long-term planning. Anyway, John, we're out of time.
We're out of time. We were joined from Philadelphia by Dave Lindorf, an investigative reporter and founder of This Can't Be Happening, as well as a columnist for Counterpunch and a contributor to Business Week, The Nation, Extra, and Salon.com. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
National Public Radio, a government-funded operation, cited the online news site The Daily Beast, which reported unequivocally today that, quote, the Russian intelligence agency behind the 2016 election cyber attacks targeted Senator Claire McCaskill as she began her 2018 re-election campaign, unquote. The Daily Beast cites as proof its own forensic analysis and specifically blames the GRU, Russia's military intelligence service. We're joined from Virginia by Joe Loria. He's the editor-in-chief of Consortium News, founded by the late Robert Perry, and he's the author of the book How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. We're also joined from New York by Ted Rall. He's an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You can check out his work at www.rall.com. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we get started, I want to play an audio clip of what I believe to be a truly disgusting National Public Radio interview this morning. We're only going to play a couple words of it, but it says so much about the media in the United States and about this assertion categorically made that the Russians have now begun their war against the 2018 midterm elections. Let's listen to this audio clip from this morning, NPR.
U.S. intelligence officials said the Russians were going to try to hack the midterm elections. Now it appears to have happened. The target is one of this fall's most vulnerable Democrats, Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill. NPR congressional reporter Kelsey Snell is with us in the studio now. Hey, Kelsey.
Good morning.
What can you tell us?
Well, this is the first known target of Russian interference in the 2018 election. It was first reported by the Daily Beast, and they found that Russian hackers made an unsuccessful attempt to breach McCaskill's computer system through targeted emails.
All right, so there it is. Case closed, Ted.
Case closed. So I did read the Daily Beast piece and listen to the NPR piece. And the first thing that jumps out at me is, of course, as usual with American media spin, it's always about what they don't say. So they say Russian hackers, and they just say Russian hackers a lot in these pieces. Well, you know, Russia's a very big country. Hundreds of millions of people live in Russia. So, and there's a lot of hackers. There's a lot of Russian hackers. There's Chinese hackers. There's American hackers.
There's American hackers?
So, yes.
Do they ever imitate Russians?
They certainly do, and some of them do work for U.S. intelligence, but the vast majority of hackers in all countries do not. So what we really, so then there's the question of, well, how do they identify, how can they say, well, this is a government, this is a Russian state activity, and all we have, and I read the Daily Beast piece several times, all they have is a quote-unquote Daily Beast forensics analysis, and nowhere in the article is it defined or described what such a forensics analysis could be. Now, people who might remember the alleged hack of Sony Pictures by the government of North Korea will remember that it's actually very difficult to identify the source of a hack because hackers notoriously put all sorts of fake leads in their coding and leave it behind in order to put investigators off the scent and send them in the wrong direction. And so you need to have someone. I mean, it's almost really impossible to say, for anyone who's experts will tell you, it's very, very difficult to say, okay, so the source of this particular hack came from this particular, is this particular thing. It's just almost impossible to say with any certitude. The NSA can't figure this stuff out. So I don't think the Daily Beast, with their limited budget, having worked for them, I can tell you they have a very limited budget. I don't think they could have possibly come up with anything. And if they did, they should have explained what it was. What is their forensics analysis? This is just really shoddy journalism.
Yeah, but Joe Loria, NPR congressional reporter Kelsey Snell, she must be a forensic expert, no? I mean, she was so categorical.
Bedrock of journalism is skepticism, and that has gone out the door completely in this story. I'm glad that Ted read the Daily Beast story twice, because I only read it once, and I only saw one mention of this forensic analysis in the paragraph number 2. It's never mentioned again. There's no link to anything about what it might have been, who did it, what they found. No details. Just an assertion that they did a forensic analysis. If you read longer into the story, they link to another Daily Beast story earlier, which talks about Fancy Bear, that apparently this was the same group, Fancy Bear, that tried to get Spearfish into McCaskill's office. Now, this second piece quotes researchers, only researchers. Don't know who these researchers are. But researchers say that the person who did the spear phishing of John Podesta's emails was this fancy bear, and he occasionally slipped in there in the code his nickname, Kozak.
Well, that, like all Russian hackers, would, because they're that dumb, would want to use the code name Cossack, right?
Precisely. These are very sophisticated operations.
Because they decided Putin had already been taken as their handle, so they went with Cossack.
Yeah, well, I suppose so. Well, anyway, just turns out that the indictments from the DOJ and Mueller from last week of the 12 GRU military intelligence agents, one of them, one Lieutenant Nikolai Kozacek, used a variety of monikers, the indictment says, including Kozak. So there's the proof.
There's the proof.
Could it possibly be a hand worked backwards, that they already, this information about Kozak was already out there by researchers, and then the prosecutors put this in the indictment? We are never going to know the evidence, Brian, because this will never come to court. They never have to show the evidence. They just laid out this indictment, and they knew. They knew that NPR and all the corporate media hacks would take this as solid fact proven, not an indictment, and they would accept an indictment as evidence, which an indictment is not, and they would carry on this fevered media campaign, settle into the consciousness of the public that Russia is guilty. Case closed. Mueller's mission accomplished. That's what NPR was contributing to today.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Joe Luria is right. The morning, I'm going to go back. We have the transcript from this disgusting National Public Radio broadcast this morning. Here's the Morning Edition host, again, talking to NPR congressional reporter Kelsey Snell, also we know now a forensic expert. Here's what she says to asking Kelsey. This is what they've done before, right? The Russians are known to have done this phishing thing in the 2016 election. And the congressional reporter Snell reports, says right back, yeah, the reporting indicates that it's really similar to what we saw in 2016. Very similar to other ways that Russian hackers have attempted to get into U.S. email systems. Again, this is just blatant assertions without any attempt to make any documented proof. And that's what happens in the media. You know, we know about the big lie. If it's a big enough lie and you repeat it enough times, it's just established as an article of faith. Go ahead, Ted.
If you have email, you get phished. Everybody gets phished. I receive phishing attacks all the time. I attempt to reset my password, or I get hacked all the time. People try to break into my email and so that they can send out spam messages. I suspect, is it possible that some of those originate with individuals in Russia? Absolutely. Is it possible that they originate in Ohio? Absolutely. Who knows? And phishing is not if you get phished, it doesn't mean that you're being phished by Russians. Now, what is notable about this story, and it's really the only thing they've got, is that they weren't trying to fish, for example, to say, hey, your Bank of America password needs to be reset. It was a U.S. Senate website made to look like a legitimate U.S. Senate website that the Senate staff might need to use. So that's interesting. It means that these hackers customized this hack, but the hack could have originated from anywhere. There's no indication from these articles that it's a nation state. It's kind of like we just don't know. For all we know, it could have been a disgruntled former staffer. It could be anyone, and it's just weird. Just like this seems to be coming so normal. You know, it used to be in journalism that you were told if your mother loves you, says she loves you, check it out. But nobody checks anything out anymore. Last week, Michael Cohen released a purported audio tape of himself speaking with President Trump. And I went online to see if any news outlet had attempted to have the audio authenticated or enhanced to reveal, especially since there's a debate as to what Trump actually said. He takes issue with the way he's quoted in the news. And no media outlet, to my knowledge, has even attempted to dig into this audio. They just post it online, and there it is. I mean, this was not the standard when I got into journalism 30, 40 years ago. The editors would just never have tolerated this kind of shoddy reporting. And I think it is, we have a lot more reporting but it's of much lower quality than existed. It's just a bunch of crap now.
This is the technique, Joe. You make an assertion with an unproved allegation, treat it as an absolute fact, cite some other unnamed researchers or sources, then build a story and a narrative around this unproved fact. And so here, let's go forward with the NPR story. The morning host says to Kelsey Snell, the congressional reporter from the NPR, why her, meaning McCaskill, why did the Russians target her? Snell responds, well, McCaskill is one of the most prominent critics of Russia and of President Trump. She is very outspoken on this, which she noted in her own statement, that this is something that she expects that she would be targeted. But she's also in a really competitive race. Missouri is seen as one of those places that could very easily go red in 2018, and she's a close ally of Hillary Clinton and has been a strong critic of Putin. So this is something that she said that she was prepared for, meaning the attack by Russia. So again, Joe, a whole narrative and story weaved around unproved facts.
And these are non sequiturs, too. These protestations that she's weak and she's in a red state and she's a blue Democrat and et cetera, et cetera. They have nothing to do with the point that's being made. The point that's being made is a very serious accusation. There's nothing then to back it up. And then they tell us, just like the CIA and NSA and FBI do, to just take their word for it.
Go ahead, Joe.
Well, I mean, she was a big critic of Russia. The entire establishment is. And there's also the Michael Cohen saying that about the collusion, so-called meeting in the Trump Tower. He writes in an article in the Chris Casillo under a headline, Michael Cohen just dropped a collusion bomb in the Russia investigation. He writes that this would prove the denials by the president wrong and would be the biggest step to date in proving, in parentheses, or at least suggesting, real collusion between the Trump team. This is what it's come to. Their headline says he dropped a bomb. And now in a parentheses, he says, well, maybe it's only a suggestion. This is what we've come to in this story.
Yeah, indeed. We're going to keep following it. There's numerous other stories that have come out like this today.
Oh, yes.
Sadly, this is the state of the U.S. media. And again, the new unofficial religion of America. We hate Russia. Russia's involved in hostile acts of animus, maybe threats of near war against the states. No evidence required.
We are out of time. We were joined from Virginia by Joe Loria. He's the editor-in-chief of Consortium News, founded by the late Robert Perry, and he's also the author of the hilarious book, How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. We were joined from New York by Ted Rall. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You can check out his work at rall.com. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Donald Trump thought he had a deal with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan to release a U.S. pastor being held in Turkey on trumped-up espionage charges in exchange for Israel releasing a Turkish woman being held on espionage charges there. But that deal fell apart, leading to angry and threatening tweets between the two leaders. The result has been a quick and significant downturn in U.S.-Turkish relations. We're joined from Washington by Gurnar Tol, the founding director of the Middle East Institute's Center for Turkish Studies. She's also a former professor and has taught courses on Islamist movements in Western Europe, on Turkey, world politics, and the Middle East. Welcome to the show, Professor.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Tell us exactly what this means for U.S.-Turkish relations. It's unusual for President Trump to tweet angrily at President Erdogan. They had something of a mutually respectful relationship, it seemed. They got along at the handful of summits where they've seen each other. But this was very angry. What do you make of it?
Well, indeed, this is not very typical of President Trump. In fact, I think this is the latest blow to a relationship that's been suffering for a long time. And there are many issues, many problems facing the bilateral relationship. So this has been the latest blow. 2017 was particularly difficult for bilateral relations. In 2017, U.S. took an unprecedented step and suspended visa services in Turkey in response to Turkish officials Brussels jailing arrest of several American citizens and also local employees of U.S. Consulates in Turkey. So 2017 was difficult. And there are other issues that's very concerning to Washington, like Turkey's very close partnership and particularly military partnership with Russia. And also there's a Turkish Islamic scholar living in Pennsylvania, and Turkish government is accusing him. His name is Fethullah Gülen. He's accusing him of orchestrating the failed coup in Turkey. Turkey has been demanding his extradition. So those are the main issues. So this latest one, the case of Andrew Brunson, has been President Trump and Vice President Mike Pence has been personally interested in his release and appealed to President Erdogan several times during bilateral meetings. And I think the American senators visited President Erdogan right after critical elections at the end of June this year. And I think the expectations in Washington were high. People thought that he would be released because the American side conveyed the displeasure in Washington, and they talked about sanctions to be imposed on Turkey if Turkey does not release Andrew Brunson. So I think this came as a surprise for the Turkey side. Of course, putting him to house arrest was a positive step, but apparently for the American side, this wasn't enough.
We're speaking from Washington with Professor Gernot Toll, the founding director of the Middle East Institute Center for Turkish Studies. She's also a former professor and has taught courses on Islamist movements in Western Europe, on Turkey, world politics, and the Middle East. Brian, you and I talk about Turkey a lot in the context of the Syrian conflict, but the U.S.-Turkish relationship is so much more complicated than that.
And becoming more complicated. Of course, there was the coup or near coup, the failed coup in 2016, where the Turkish government believed, I think, that if the Obama administration hadn't given a green light, perhaps it was a yellow light to the coup makers, certainly hadn't alerted Erdogan to the danger until, you know, and when the coup was actually being suppressed. Since then, there have been many, many other tensions, as the professor is pointing out. Of course, NATO is the eastern flank. Turkey is the eastern flank of NATO, a very crucial central part of NATO and NATO's calculations. But here we have, even today, as we're talking, President Erdogan, along with other heads of state from the BRICS countries, are meeting together. Turkey's not an official member of BRICS, but Turkey's there. Professor, can you envision a possible realignment, big picture realignment of Turkish politics?
Well, it's already happening. But of course, what is important is what this realignment means and whether it will lead to a dramatic step, a Turkish step maybe away from NATO. I think the realignment, the major realignment in Turkish politics is the alignment of the former Islamists, which is the ruling party and Erdogan's party, and the Turkish nationalists. Turkish nationalists, they've been playing an important role in Erdogan's plans to centralize power in his own hands. They struck the alliance in 2015, and since then they've been working very closely. And it was thanks to the nationalist alliance that President Erdogan struck, he could be able to win both the presidency and the parliamentary majority in June elections. So what does that realignment mean is very critical for Washington, I think. Turkey is already a very nationalist country, and the fact that Erdogan needs the nationalists to retain his parliamentary majority, but also there's a significant nationalist presence in Turkish bureaucracy. So Erdogan will need this alliance. And the nationalists, and they're not alone, we can talk about other segments of society that is equally anti-American, but particularly nationalists, they are very suspicious of the West. And there are people, including in the military, who have been promoting the idea that it's time for Turkey to turn away from NATO, to turn away from the U.S., and cultivate closer ties to countries like Russia. And that's why I think within this context for Washington, what's happening in that alliance between Russia and Turkey, it's very concerning to the Americans and other NATO partners.
Professor, what happens then in the greater context of the relationship if this issue over the pastor can't be resolved? The House of Representatives voted this week to withhold F-35 fighter jets that Turkey already has paid for. If it's not resolved, do you think that there can be some conclusion to this?
Yes, certainly. I think especially the Congress, they've been very, very serious about this. And even at times when Trump was hesitant to say anything against President Erdogan, and I think he still wants to have close ties to Erdogan. But I think the pressure on President Trump is mounting, not only from the Congress, but also from the larger American society, which wasn't really interested or wasn't really following Turkish politics closely before. But due to the Andrew Brunson case and several other cases, like the instance when Turkish president's bodyguards attacked peaceful protesters here in Washington. So he almost became a household name. And that's why I think there's a lot of pressure on President Trump to play hardball with Erdogan. So if in this case, after those tweets, we haven't seen a reaction from President Erdogan. But I think this is the case of Andrew Brunson is the easiest case for him to give the U.S. what it wants. Because on other issues like Turkey's decision to purchase a Russian missile defense system S-400 or the upcoming Iran sanctions, for instance, there is not much room to maneuver for the Turkish president. Whereas with the case of Andrew Brunson, it's relatively easier for him. But of course, the problem here is after Trump's very harsh tweet and Mike Pence's very harsh statement, if Erdogan releases Andrew Brunson, he will look weak to his domestic constituency.
And here we had also, just to put in this complicated mix, U.S. lawmakers, the U.S. Congress, moving closer to what appears to be an outright ban on sales of F-35 jets to its NATO ally, Turkey. I mean, it's such a moving set of circumstances. When you think back as how dynamic this was, when Michael Flynn was short-lived national security advisor was coming in, it appeared that he was, and perhaps was, a registered, or at that time, an unregistered agent of the Erdogan government. The Turkish government must have felt it had a different kind of or a better relationship than it did with Obama in the last 2 years. All of that has gone south. Go ahead. We have about a minute left.
No, certainly. That was the expectation. And even till this day, Ankara is receiving very mixed messages from Washington. Just a few weeks ago in Helsinki during the NATO summit, President Trump said very kind words about President Erdogan, praised his efforts. But on the other hand, you have the Congress that is threatening to impose sanctions against Turkey. So that leads to a lot of confusion in Ankara. So I think there's a circle of people in Ankara around President Erdogan who tell him that, in fact, President Trump is okay and we can work with him. But of course, that hasn't been the case. But for Ankara, this confusion is difficult to resolve because they keep receiving these mixed messages.
All right. We're going to have to leave it there, John.
We do. We have to leave it there. Unfortunately, we are out of time. We were joined from Washington by Gurnar Toll, the founding director of the Middle East Institute Center for Turkish Studies. She's also a former professor, and she's taught courses on Islamist movements in Western Europe, on Turkey, world politics, and the Middle East. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
It's Friday, and that means it's time to look at the week's worst and most misleading headlines. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefteye.blogspot.com. And we're joined here in the studio by Loud and Clear producer Nicole Russell. Welcome back.
Thanks.
Delighted to be here.
Steve, there are a lot of stories again this week. Some are funny, some are hilarious.
Some are disgusting.
Some are disgusting.
Some are disgusting.
Where would you like to start? I know where I want to start.
The story of the week comes from courtesy of FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. But the headline I'm going to read actually comes from the Salon article, which talked about the FAIR study. And the headline reads as follows. MSNBC has done 455 Stormy Daniels segments in the last year, but none on the U.S. war in Yemen. So this definitely qualifies for the most disgusting story of the week. And it's a perfect example of what I called fake news by omission, or what we could also call headlines you didn't see. Because if you're a regular MSNBC viewer, you know nothing about the U.S. war in Yemen, although you know a lot about Stormy Daniels.
Yeah, I agree with you. It is fake news by omission. There's a lot of that. I mean, if we went down on the K Street right here and did a poll and say, what do you think of the U.S. war in Yemen? Most people, I'm guessing, would say, what, there is no U.S. war in Yemen. And of course, there's not a U.S. direct war in Yemen. It's the Saudi war in Yemen. But the U.S. is actually refueling the Saudi tankers. The U.S., of course, has agreed to sell under Trump, as they did under Obama, $110 billion in arms to the Saudi royal family. And the Pentagon is actually coordinating with the Saudi pilots about what areas to target. In other words, what areas to bomb. So there is a U.S. war in Yemen. And again, everybody knows everything about the Stormy Daniels story. Nothing about this criminal war, which I have to say constitutes one of the great human catastrophes of modern times. I mean, and I'm not saying that with exaggeration.
No, not at all. But and it's not just MSNBC. Let's be very clear about that. We've seen Stormy Daniels' face on every single, you know, major news outlet. You know, in the newsroom here at Sputnik, we have multiple TVs on showing, you know, a multitude of different stations.
And that's just a form of punishment.
It feels like it sometimes, you know, and so many of them, whenever there's any tiny piece of news about Stormy Daniels, that's all you see. It's all you see. And I don't remember ever seeing anything about Yemen on any of them except for RT.
Let me just add to that from a story from this week, which happened on Wednesday, which was equally egregious to the Yemen story, which is Syria. On Syria, ISIS suicide bombers, terrorists, killed 215 people in Syria. And I looked very carefully, and neither BBC World News, this is the televised news, nor ABC Nightly News, those are the two things I watch, neither of them mentioned the fact that 215 people were killed by ISIS suicide bombers. So again, it's another horrible case of the headlines you didn't see or fake news by omission. It's just really disgusting.
And there's another part to that story, too, which is, again, for Americans, just think if there was a suicide bomber in the United States that took the lives in a single incident of more than 200 people, that would be the only news. And the U.S. would be readying the planes to take off and engage in the next military confrontation on the basis of fighting the war on terror. But in addition to it not being reported about what happened to Syrian people, the fact that the terrorists are also the enemies of the Assad government, and the U.S. government has since 2011 been insisting that it be Assad's government that goes. Assad must fall. There's never been a clear, consistent opposition to those engaged in this kind of terrorist activities because their target was also the U.S. government's target. So again, it's the United States, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, making league with, in essence, armed right-wing religious terrorist organizations who are trying to overthrow the secular government in Damascus.
Exactly. Well, time for a change of tone. So let's switch tone completely to the Schadenfreude story of the week. And this story reads, Betsy DeVos's $40 million family yacht was untied, causing $10,000 in damages. So
she has a $40 million. John, I mean, you did some of the dimensions on that yacht. I mean, That's a big yacht.
And you know, we ought not to even call it a yacht. I would call it an ocean-going ship, because that's really what it is. The thing is, you know, half of a football field and has room for 100 and something people.
Think of all the public schools you could fund.
Imagine.
And raises for public school teachers.
And teachers wouldn't have to email us at the beginning of the school year to ask for donations of pencils and paper.
Yeah, so this is one of 10 boats owned by the DeVos family. And they also own at least 4 planes and 2 helicopters. So they are, You know, they got plenty of options for
travel. I wonder if they got any of their boats and planes from Blackwater.
I wouldn't be surprised because Eric Prince is her brother.
Yeah.
Although
the CEO this mercenary group.
This has to be her husband's Ponzi scheme Amway money, right? I mean, that's where this money comes from, I think.
Yeah, they have to. Well, it's not from the salary of a public school teacher. It's a $40 million yacht. It became untethered somehow. Nicole was smiling because she thought it was the work of a person. But we don't know. We don't know what happened. I mean, the rope might have just come undone.
Yeah, I'm sure with a $40 million yacht, you just tie it up a little string, right?
Yeah.
Mistakes happen.
Yeah. I also just want to add on this story that, you know, this is reported in a bunch of different places. This was a CBS News headline in particular. But I didn't know one of the sources in the story is a site I didn't know existed, and it's the Super Yacht Fan website. I had no idea that there were, I guess, people who collect super. Well, are you talking about super yachts, or are you a super fan of yachts? I don't know, but either way, it's just really
well.
Exciting.
We're grateful to them for they brought this out.
This is great reporting.
We know about this because
you,
of the Super Yacht Fan website. You know, Vladimir Putin. He's thought of everything in terms of bringing down America. Everything.
Everything.
And but who would have thought that at Helsinki, he duped Donald Trump? Let's talk about this headline.
Okay. The headline, which appeared everywhere, really, but this is the CNN headline. Putin gave Trump a soccer ball that may have a transmitter chip.
Well, ding, 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 ding.
My God.
Because he would keep that in the Oval Office, of course.
Right?
They were trying to keep track of Barron because maybe Barron was going to play with it. This was actually a lot of serious discussion by the talking heads
so
on MSNBC.
Yes.
It's a complete joke because the chip in this ball, this is a standard Adidas World Cup soccer ball, is what's called an NFC or near field communications chip, which is exactly the kind of thing if you have Apple Pay or Google Pay on your cell phone and you touch it to a little thing on the counter so you can actually pay for your bill at McDonald's or wherever. This is exactly the same kind of thing. So the transmission of this chip, the range of it is exactly 1 inch. So
Steve is just covering up for the Russians again.
Russian stooge, Steve Pat. Yeah, no, that's definitely right. And let's be clear about how many layers of security this kind of stuff is going to go through. Like, this is not, even if this was some harebrained plot that he came up with, this is not going to happen. It's just absolutely ridiculous. And yet, hand-wringing commenced.
Maybe they sent a soccer ball to Claire McCaskill.
Oh, that's what it was. That's what it was. Yeah.
Somebody's been sending something to Claire McCaskill.
Maybe.
Maybe.
The point of the story is precisely the whole concept of this segment, which is headlines, which is a lot of people, you could read the story and understand that they put the ball through security, et cetera, et cetera. But if you just skim in the paper and you see this headline or you heard the brief thing on the news, all you're going to hear is Trump got a soccer ball from Putin that has a transmitter chip in it. And you're going to think, oh, my God, those dastardly Russians. So it's the effect of headlines, which are important. And again, that's kind of the part of the concept of this whole segment.
And it plays into two stereotypes, which is great, about Trump being dumb, which is probably true. And, Russia being dastardly and very villainous.
Exactly.
Delightful.
Let's keep going.
Let's go to Facebook, which everybody uses, or 2.5 billion people do, so most of your listeners probably. And the headline, which, again, everyone probably heard this morning or yesterday, Facebook stock in free fall because everyone already uses it. So, it's not funny. I mean, it is funny. Who knows? It's not funny if you own the stock that the stock fell by $50 a share.
What would have been funny is how much, what was the value, John?
It lost $100 billion in value yesterday. And so far today, another $36 billion.
Yeah. And Zuckerberg lost like $16 billion overnight.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you lose $16 billion?
Overnight.
It says a lot about the system. But I think the better headline would have been many, many people unfriend Mark Zuckerberg.
That's right.
You got a second career there as a headline writer, Brian.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, this is classic capitalism 101. Why did the stock fall? Because they have so many users, there's no room for them to get any more. They have 2.5 billion users already and there's only 4 billion people online, which includes, kids and whatever. So basically people decided that they can't get any bigger. So,
and that's the thing about capitalism. You're right. It's expand or die. So if there's no place more to expand, anyway, I'm not forecasting the death of Facebook.
No, certainly not. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area was Steve Patt. Steve's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefteye.blogspot.com. And we were joined here in the studio by Loud and Clear producer Nicole Russell. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.